pals of mine. It's a twofer show. I've got authors introducing their books and Earth Day info. First up, I recently attended a book event and asked authors from a variety of genres to introduce their books to you.
Well, my name is Bill Piper. This is my first story collection. It's about my fourth book, I guess. And this is a collection of 12 stories that are really all over the map. They're not linked as to theme. They are linked to be fun for the reader, so that one will flow into the next, but you deal with everything from, the marijuana underground in Humboldt County, to a woman who dreams that she has sex with an alien and tries to figure out why she would dream something that weird.
Well, what's the name of your book?
It's called Forgive Me, Father. That's the name of the title story, or the lead story, the one that comes up first. And that one deals with the sex abuse scandals in the Catholic Church.
My name is Susan Spann, and my most recent book is Blade of the Samurai. And it is about the adventures of ninja detective Hiro Hattori and his Portuguese Jesuit sidekick, Father Mateo, who have to solve the murder of the shogun's cousin in 16th century Japan.
Seems like only yesterday.
It does, indeed. And so they have to fight with a female samurai, and there are mysterious maids and missing stable boys and all kinds of suspects. And lo and behold, in 3 days' time, an ambassador from the shogun's rival will come to Kyoto to talk with the shogun. And if the killer is not found before that time, the shogun will force the detectives to take the place of the murderer so that he has heads to show his rival when he arrives.
But I see you've got another book on here as well. A couple of them, actually.
Yes, the first book is actually called Claws of the Cat, and that is where we meet Hiro and Father Mateo for the first time. And they must solve the murder of a samurai general who dies in a tea house. And a teenage geisha is accused of the crime. And the dead man's son, who is a police lieutenant, gives them only a couple of days to find the killer before he will execute both the teenage geisha and the priest who the ninja has pledged his life to protect.
Tell me a little backstory of you and how you approach this creative world.
Well, I was actually getting ready for work one morning and had the idea pop into my head, most ninjas commit murders, but Hiro Hattori solves them. And I thought this was fascinating. So this detective just sprang to mind immediately, just out of the blue. And I thought, this is a book I have to write. And so I just absolutely fell in love with Hiro, who's a ninja. The Japanese word for ninja is shinobi, so that's why the books are called the Shinobi Mysteries. And Hiro needed a sidekick, because a lot of Westerners don't understand Japanese culture well. And so I had the idea that if he were charged with guarding a Portuguese priest who would know a little bit about Japanese culture, but not a lot, it would provide a set of Western eyes for readers to be able to engage with this fascinating and exotic culture. And so Hiro and Father Mateo became partners, and I've loved writing with them.
Hi, my name is Linda Townsend. The name of my book is Focused on Murder, a Spirit-like Mystery. It's the first in a series set in northern Minnesota. This one is set in the dead of winter, and my protagonist is Britt Johansson. She's a photojournalist, 34-year-old photojournalist, with a big heart and kind of a bad attitude. She's working in, as I said, in northern Minnesota, and she's covering the murder of a local co-ed. The sheriff believes that he has his guy, a Native American kid from the reservation, the nearby reservation. Britt doesn't think so. She keeps digging and discovers something that ends her up in the crosshairs of an international crime ring that uses the U.S.-Canadian border as the entry point for its dirty deeds. And how she's in way over her head, so you'll have to read the book to find out how she handles it all.
And are you from Minnesota?
Yes, I am. Northern Minnesota. But I've lived in California for many, many years. But I wanted to set my book in the place where I grew up. You know, it's on a beautiful, idyllic lake. But I also wanted to sort of peel back the layers a little bit and show maybe an underside of these beautiful little tourist towns. But it's all fictional, of course. Nothing like that really happens.
That we know about.
That we know about.
All right. My name is Mark Wiederanders, and my book's title is Stevenson's Treasure, and it's the story of Robert Louis Stevenson's year in California when he was pursuing the love of his life, Fanny Osborne, who is a San Francisco woman. So the book takes place within a year. She was an artist who had three children and was unhappily married. He was Scottish, 10 years younger, and was totally unknown and not in good health. So it was an odd kind of a relationship. They got together and sparks flew, and it was a very, very difficult time for them to figure out in 1879 how to engineer her divorce so that they could have a future together. So that's what the story is about. And it takes place in Monterey, San Francisco, Calistoga, Scotland, you know, some very romantic locales. And it was a ball to write. So that's it in a nutshell.
So how did the story pique your interest?
I first got interested when I was visiting a relative in Carmel, and I saw a little book that said that Stevenson had been there in 1879 hiking and collapsed and almost died, and some ranchers nursed him to health. And I just got really interested in what was this Scottish kid doing in Carmel, California in 1879. So I started reading, and turned out that he was pursuing this love interest of his, and was going to do everything it took. You know, he was going to risk his life until he got this woman to go back to Europe with him.
And he did it.
And he did it. Yeah, right. Obviously, he was successful and then became a very famous writer.
So my name is Catherine Lewis, and the name of the book is Sparks, and it's a thriller. And it has a heroine who, of course, finds out that her company's being spied on by another company, and this is at the time of the great financial crash of 2009. So she has to find a way out of it for herself and her company, and of course, on the way, she falls in love. And so it's a thriller with a love story.
Do you have any personal experience in this arena?
Well, maybe not the love story part. But, yeah, I've worked in, you know, technical industry for a long time, so I wrote about what I know about. And, you know, people think that with technical companies you have nerds and it's dry and everybody's just holed up in their own little office. But actually, at that level of business, people who have that much technical knowledge also have very huge egos, and they do all sorts of things. They break the rules, they bend the rules, they attack each other, because it's all about getting to the finish line first. So it's actually pretty exciting at that level of business.
It's the American way.
Yes, it is.
My name is Elaine Faber, and I am an author of a cat mystery series. The first one is called Black Cat's Legacy. The second one is Black Cat and the Lethal Lawyer. And the third one is coming out next week. It's called Black Cat and the Accidental Angel. So in my stories, the cat is one of the point of view characters. He tells part of the story through his eyes. In the first book, he tells about 20% of it, as most of the story involves a lady who is trying to solve her father's murder in a small town. And the cat is there to help her solve the crime. Well, of course, that all ends in a happy romance, and the lady gets married to the author who's there writing a book about the murder. You know, coincidentally, he's there the same day. Anyway, same week. And in the second book, they travel to Texas to her grandmother's ranch, because she says she wants to leave an inheritance to her granddaughter, one of her granddaughters. But she really has an evil intent. She's being manipulated by her attorney, and she wants to change her will and leave it to one of her granddaughters. But before she does that, the attorney says he's going to have to kill her, because he doesn't want her to do that. He wants her to leave all his money, her money, to the fake children's society he's set up. So when the cat hears that the murder is afoot, naturally he's got to try to prevent the murder.
Naturally.
Naturally, as all cats would do, loving their people as they do. So we have a little bit of intrigue and scary and a little bit, but not so much. My books are called cozy mysteries, so that means they're written without profanity, without extreme violence or sex. So they're a nice clean read for folks who don't want all that kind of thing in their mystery, but they still want a good, intriguing mystery.
And the cats are not magic.
They're not magic cats. They just talk to each other. They talk to each other. They don't talk to people, and they don't walk through walls or anything.
The adult book in Canada, is it true?
No.
No,
no, I don't know. But my cats are just fun. They love their people, and they love to solve mysteries, but they don't walk through walls. So.
My name is Rebecca Blanton. The book is Love Letters to a Unicorn, a book about kink, BDSM, and non-monogamy. And it's a book about what I learned about good relationships in 25 years in the kink community. So things like education, negotiation, involving the community, boundaries, and how to live a very healthy relationship that may not look what your parents modeled or what you see on TV.
So what was your impetus for writing this? Was it a particular incident or a conversation maybe you had?
No, I've been in the community for 25 years, so a lot of these are conversations I've had with various people. And then I started dating somebody who wasn't part of that community, and it was my explanation to him about my life.
I'm Amy Rogers, and my debut novel was called Petroplague, and my current book is called Reversion. I write science-themed thrillers in the style of Michael Crichton. So my first book, Petroplague, is about bacteria that turn gasoline into vinegar, get into the fuel supply of Los Angeles, and paralyze the city. It's a disaster, and it reads like a movie. I also have a publishing company called Science Thrillers Media, which you can learn about at sciencethrillersmedia.com, and I publish books that have real science or medicine in the plot, or feature a scientist or a physician or an engineer as the protagonist. And so it's a series of books that really appeal to people who like hard science fiction.
CSI fans.
Yes.
My name is Arthur Harmar. My book is titled Into the Land of Darkness. It is a story about my cruise, 50 missions in Korea, bombing, strafing missions during the course of the Korean War, which extended from 1950 through 1953.
And I'm assuming that your kinfolk have asked you to put this down, and you probably realize that a lot of people could benefit from this information as well, besides just the storytelling.
Fortunately, I wrote this book over the past 8 years. I have PTSD. For 50-odd years after I came back from Korea, I couldn't talk about it, I couldn't think about it. I tried not to think about it. I buried it. I tried deliberately not to remember what I had experienced. Actually, this book has been my therapy. By writing the book, which is a collection of 50 nonfiction short stories, there's been a reliving of those experiences and a cathartic effect. And now the book is being read by a number of people who were in Korea during that time, 50-53, but also from subsequent wars, Vietnam, Afghanistan, Iraq, have read the book, they've written to me, they've contacted me on email, and they are using the concepts that I use to better handle the problem of PTSD. I'm not totally cured, I probably never will be, but I now understand why I have PTSD symptoms frequently and recurringly, but I'm better able to handle it. Writing the book has been cathartic, and I hope it helps many, many more people. In fact, what I try to do, and I've succeeded now on 6-7 occasions, I've caused these other people who read the book and contacted me to start writing their own book, giving vent to their pent-up emotions, feelings of guilt, terror, remorse. It's been so the book, to me, has been a fulfillment. If I never sold one book, the book, in my opinion, would be a success because it's helped me so much. It's elongated my life and has greatly enriched my life.
Well done, sir.
Thank you.
My name is Cindy Sample, and I write the Laurel McKay Humorous Mystery Series, primarily in El Dorado County and Sacramento. And two of the books have reached the bestseller list on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and three of the books have been finalists for the Lefty Award for Best Humorous Mystery. So they've been described as Irma Bombeck meets Agatha Christie. The books are named Dying for a Date, Dying for a Dance, Dying for a Daiquiri, and Dying for a Dude, and I'm currently working on Dying for a Donut.
I was wondering as you were in Mystery, okay, what else? So how many do you have? That's four you've got so far?
Yep. I have four books out right now, and after Dying for a Donut, we'll be Dying for a Diamond. And I have 112 titles to work with, so I'm going to be writing a long time.
Now, are they all in the same female characters at different for each book?
Yeah. Yeah. The protagonist is a 39-year-old single soccer mom, and she has a mother who's a 62-year-old real estate broker who's playing a larger and larger role these days.
My name is Maureen O'Leary Wankett, and I'm here with two books. One is called How to Be Manly, which is a young adult contemporary realistic fiction about a young man with a lot of problems, and he thinks joining the football team is going to solve them all. And I'm also here with The Arrow, released by Geminid Press, and it's a paranormal urban fantasy about the modern incarnation of the ancient fertility goddess Bridget. And she faces a lot of awful woes, a lot of modern evil. I was just fascinated with the idea of what if an ancient deity was facing modern evil? What would she do? Like what kind of resources would she gather to fight that? So I got to explore that.
My name is Olivia Rivers. My novels are Frostfire and Counting Shadows. I also have a teen contemporary coming out in spring 2016 called Tone Deaf. And they're all teen novels, mostly fantasy, and then some contemporary realistic fiction.
And your first one?
The first one out was Frostfire. It's a young adult paranormal romance. It's basically just Romeo and Juliet, but with demons. And so it's got a lot of action in it, some romance, and it's... it's mostly for a teen market.
Romeo and Juliet didn't end well. Does yours?
You'll have to find out in the second book.
Okay. So what is this second one about?
The second one is called Counting Shadows, and it is about a girl who discovers that she is a reincarnated mythical figure, and the boy who she's in love with is actually the boy that she was born to kill.
Bummer.
Yes. See? So it's as compared to urban fantasy.
My name's Lee Dragoon, and the name of the book is Queen of Rogues. It's an official Adventure Time novel. So it's about one of the characters within...
I can't interrupt you. What does that mean, official time travel?
Oh, no. Adventure Time's a Cartoon Network animated TV show, and they decided to do a bunch of tie-in prose novels. So they're prose novels about characters inside the show, but it's supposed to be fanfic written by one of the show's characters about the other characters on the show, which is why my name is not on the cover. So this one's like a pirate adventure type story. And then there's another one my friend Adrian Ambrose wrote that's more of a faux Scottish romance. And then I just did one that's coming out called The Lonesome Outlaw that's a old western cowboy one, but it's sort of a train heist type thing.
Of course.
I know. And then I get to work on another one that's faux Pompeii, and I read a lot of books about Pompeii, so I'm excited about that one.
Nice.
My name is Norman Miller, and I have four books here today. This is a tween book, and it is called The Magic Cowgirl Boots, and it's about a young girl in the year 2006 that gets a pair of cowgirl boots and gets transported back to become her own great-great-grandmother in 1877 in Nebraska. And she has to learn what it's like to be working hard on a farm to stay alive. Kind of an interesting experience, as you can imagine.
A good camera angle for her.
It would be neat. The next two books are part of a series of three. Third one's still being written. This is called Canvasback Creek and Canvasback Creek 2. These are set in 1858 and 1859, again in Nebraska. A young 13-year-old girl her and her 5-year-old sister are the only survivors in her family from a cholera epidemic, and the 13-year-old has to protect her sister and save her from Comancheros that capture her and are going to sell her to the Comanche Indians. Then they find out that their father, who had died earlier, was from a very rich family back in Boston. They didn't know about it. And the second book, they're heading back to Boston to find their grandmother. The third book, they found the grandmother and they're heading back to Nebraska. So,
well, tell me about some of the books that you read when you were a kid.
Oh, I read everything I could get my hands on. Very eclectic. I love all kinds of genres, science fiction, historical novels, because I really like historical novels.
I mean, when you're a kid, though. Like, say, 10 years old.
Oh, my God. I mean, everything. Asimov, you know, science fiction books by that kind. I've read all of the, Three Musketeers, you know, the kinds of books of that.
Adventurous.
Into adventure, yeah. And like I say, I like historical, and that was always interesting to me. So Robin Hood was the most important person I could think of at the time.
Well, yeah.
I mean, yeah. So that's kind of interesting. The last book is called The Last Tritons. That's got my granddaughter's picture on the front. She and I wrote that together. It was her idea. And I wrote the book with her story. So it's a little bit of a light science fiction again. All of my books are teenage girls who get to be the heroes. You don't see too many of that.
Good job.
Thank you.
My name is Joanna Rowland, and my picture book is Always Mom, Forever Dad. It's a positive book about divorce or separation to let children know that even though things are different, it is still can be good and that they are loved.
What do you think about it?
I think it's good.
Yeah? And how old are you?
7.
What do you like? What's the best part?
That when the mom joins the beach with the dad and the daughter.
They still love her, huh? Yeah. That's not going to go away.
I'm Leanne Bigley. The name of the book is California True Tales and Taller. I originally started the book to tell my husband's tales to our grandchildren, and it has grown. Basically, it's about the tales of a man working in an era that is now past in the construction industry in PG&E, working on dams, canals, and tunnels out in the middle of God knows where. And the things an extraordinarily observant man would say about the things that he watches and does. And then some family things he throws in there too. So that's it.
My name is Kate Abbott. The book is a young adult novel called Disneylanders. And it's sort of a coming-of-age story set in Disneyland. It's about a 14-year-old girl who's on her parents' annual summer vacation. She loves Disneyland, but she's at an age where she's starting to feel kind of awkward about it. And she's just about to start high school, so she's feeling like she needs to grow up a little. But she meets a boy while waiting in line at Disneyland and makes a new friend, and they go off and have some adventures. She has her first date in Disneyland.
And those lines, as we know, are very long.
That's right.
It takes a long time to get to know somebody.
That's exactly right. And while they're in line, the rides break down sometimes, so they get stuck on rides together and have lots of time to talk and get to know each other. So,
that's a cute idea.
Thank you.
My name is Larry Brooks. The name of the book is Tan True, T-A-N-T-R-U, two words. And it's a personal memoir of my tour in 1968, serving in the Mekong Delta as an infantryman. The book starts out when I was basically a kid growing up in Southern California. Shows how I was drafted and what happened, and basically what it's like to be on the ground in the war, in the middle of the Vietnam War in the Mekong Delta. I had a kind of a pretty unique experience. So halfway through my tour, I was yanked out of my unit and sent back to Long Beach to perform body escort duty for a fellow soldier. And then about a week at home, and then back to my unit. So I really kind of split my tour up into first one and second one. Pre-body escort and post-body escort. This accounts how I got through it and what happened, and the fine people that I served with. It has a happy ending. I lived, so that's it.
There are a lot of fictional tales of war, but the real ones are a lot more interesting, aren't they?
This is absolutely real. Every word in this book is true. I think it's really heartening because a number of the people that are in the book are still friends I'm still acquainted with. Long distance wise, some of them in Southern California or back east, and they've read the book and they absolutely loved it, and we're very, very happy that one of their peers finally put this story out and put it down, put it to writing.
It's really, so a good really influence like there.
Yeah, yeah.
Good job.
My biggest fear was one of them would read it and hate it, call me up and send me a poison pen letter. But just the opposite happened, so
nice.
It worked out good.
Hi, I'm Marty E. Webb, author, photographer of Cat Mulan's Mindful Musings, Insight and Inspiration for a Wonderful Life. My Cat Mulan inspired me to create a book of her photographs with words of wisdom and humor. And my other book is Not Your Mother's Book on Cats, which I co-created, which has stories from 62 other humans with photographs of cats, funny, humorous stories.
So why is it called Not Your Mother's Book?
Because this is funny, hilarious, different, unlike the other popular anthology series. So this is not a tearjerker. It's more like laugh until you pee kind of humor. And you can read some of the stories on laughuntilyoupee.com.
Excellent.
Yes.
My name is Sally Ohms, and the name of my book is Finding Home, How Americans Prevail. I'm a journalist, and I went around the country and interviewed people who had been displaced from their homes for one reason or another. And I talked to them about how then they recreate those homes and what home means to them. So I have a variety of different people in it. I have about 10 different categories in the book. Some of them are former foster kids, veterans coming back, combat veterans coming back from war. I interviewed immigrants, Native Americans, people whose houses have been foreclosed on. I talked to women who had been abused. I talked to people who are victims of natural disasters and how they recreated, sometimes in this case their whole towns. And then there's several different kind of miscellaneous types of people who are defining home in some different ways. And,
so it's an inspirational, motivational book.
It is.
You can survive this. And
yes, exactly. Yeah, yeah, it's upbeat. Because people, I think...
you feel defeated.
Yeah, they do. They do. And so there are so many different factors that help them regain their balance, shall we say.
My name is Nancy Lee Woody, and my book is called Tears and Trombones. It's about a local kid from the Depression era who wanted to become a classical musician. And his father was a drunk, and he was a construction worker. He did not want his son to be a musician. He used humiliation to dissuade him, and finally, cruelty. So it's about how the boy maneuvers through his childhood to reach his goal. It also is a love story, a poignant love story, a triangle love story, I suppose, because the boy couldn't really make the right decisions relating to his love life when he grew up. It's a story of a mother's love for her son, and there's music throughout the book, music of all kinds, classical music, Johnny Cash, the Andrews Sisters, Stan Kenton, Tommy Dorsey, Frank Sinatra, all kinds of music, almost in every chapter. So,
nice.
It's a great story.
I'm author R.J. Machado de Quevedo, and I am the author of The Deceiver Saga. The first three books are out. The Deceiver's Book 1, Broken Seed is Book 2, and Sanctuary Fire is Book 3. I'm currently writing the fourth book, Blood Enemies, and there's going to be about 7 or 8 in this saga by the time I am complete. So I think there might be more. But that's all I'm going to say about that, because the ideas keep coming. In this saga, you have a college-age young woman who, her entire life has been nothing but one battle after the next, a complete struggle. She's witnessed murder. She's watched her sister be raped. She's had her life turned upside down. She thought it was just because her father was a sadistic man, but it turns out there was a lot more to it than that. It wasn't just him that was evil. There was evil actually driving him. So as she begins to become aware of her destiny by getting swept up and caught into another part of the world, she's literally thrust into the middle of a supernatural battle that has been raging since the dawn of time, but it's also been raging over her destiny since before she was born. And her father has been manipulated demonically to try to destroy her throughout her life, as well as some other characters that come into play in her past. So now she's learning that she has a destiny, and the whole reason why her life has been horrible has because they've been trying to stop her from realizing that destiny and even seeing the potential in herself to succeed. So if they can devastate her hope and her belief in herself, then they would have won. So now that she's becoming aware of that, she's hanging on to her faith. She's not letting her past define her. And she's getting sent on these missions around the world to seek out and find celestial artifacts that are actually going to be needed before the beginning of the end. And it's a wild, crazy adventure along the way. You have a lot of sarcasm and humor to balance out the darker moments. But there's also love and lust and just the natural pull and elements of humanity throughout the entire saga. But readers are enjoying it. They're begging for the next. And so I'm writing it as fast as I can.
Maybe you can order some knee pads for the begging on the side.
Oh, yes. That would be great. That would be great.
My name is Maceo Montoya, and my book is Letters to the Poet from His Brother, which is published last year by Co-Pilot Press. And it's a hybrid book, a memoir that's also mixed with my visual artwork and prose poems, essays about finding my voice as a writer, finding my voice as an artist, coming to term with my late brother, his death, poet Andres Montoya, and also understanding what I've inherited as the son of Chicano artist Malaquias Montoya, and how I sort through all that to create my own work.
So describe your art.
I see myself as a storyteller. So whether it's my fiction, I've also published two novels, or my visual work. I'm a painter principally, but I share narratives.
What's your favorite media?
As far as
paintings.
As paint, I paint
acrylic,
I paint in acrylic and also oils, and I also, in this book, there's a number of charcoal drawings.
I love charcoal. I can't do it myself, but
yeah.
I try. But
yeah.
I
Well, I like it as far as a storytelling medium and just the contrast between the darks, the shadows, and the highlights, and it's, you know, very expressionistic.
Well, I think that's why graphic comic books are so popular now.
Uh-huh. Yeah, no, exactly.
So your family must be very proud of you.
I hope so.
Well, I'm proud of you, and I'm related.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
They sound interesting, don't they? Now, because today is Earth Day, I wanted to share some tips and resources in case your community hasn't hosted an Earth Day event. A couple of ways to lower your electricity bill. In addition to using candles instead of lamps periodically, consider earthen floors, which retain heat during winter months, or a Zeer clay pot refrigerator. You can find instructions on the internet. Cooking-wise, there are numerous solar ovens to choose from on the internet, including do-it-yourself. Or you can contact solarcookers.org. By the way, it's another way of cutting back wood-burning methods in different parts of the world that affect our world forests. And there's light pollution. Those of us who live in cities are frustrated at how far we have to drive just to see stars. But it also affects our health, and that of other species. Jack Sales of the International Dark Sky Association shares some interesting information.
Lights that are not designed properly, that shine up into the sky and out to the side, and they should be shining down on objects we need to see. One of the problems is that light goes 100 miles or more, couple hundred miles, maybe 300 miles, blocks out the sky, the night sky, wastes energy, and even though we have more and more efficient lighting systems, it's still a waste of energy when the light goes up into the sky.
Examples of buildings or items that are doing that?
Acorn lighting fixtures.
And what is an acorn lighting fixture?
It looks like an acorn, a lot
street
of them lamp. Around Sacramento.
Oh, street
lamps.
Okay,
street lamps, street lights that don't shine just straight down. Light fixtures on the sides of buildings that don't shine straight down. They're called wall packs. Dusted-on barn lights. Security, quote, security lights that some people call insecurity lights. Those are the kind of fixtures we like to eliminate and replace. And many of them are being replaced with LEDs, which most of those are shining down where the light should be shining. But there is a very serious issue with the LEDs, even though we love them, but there's a serious problem with LEDs in that a lot of municipalities are buying the high color temperature, 4,000, 5,000, 6,000 degree Kelvin, that have way too much blue content. It's an environmental issue. It's bad for your health. It's bad for the environment, the animals' health. And what we really want to see is 3,000 degree Kelvin, the highest color temperature. And to give you an idea what this Kelvin is about, it's a color temperature of the lamp, and an incandescent lamp like we used to all have in our houses is about 2,700 degrees Kelvin. So we want to be as close to that as we can be, because that eliminates that blue content. And that the blue content does a number of things. It disrupts your circadian rhythm. It causes more light pollution because it spreads, splatters all over the sky and bounces around. That's why the daytime sky is blue. I forgot what the other one was. The high blue content causes a lot of glare. The lower color temperature creates less glare in our eyes. Blue bounces around your eyes just like it does the sky. So that's one of the things that we're very concerned about nowadays, is getting the color temperature down for all the new lights that are coming in, because they'll be around for quite a while and they're very efficient. So that's what we're going to have.
So what's your background with all of this, your interest?
Well, we got interested in this partly from the astronomy perspective, but also the fact that 20 years ago, the Albertsons, six blocks away from us, put two big floodlights on the top of their building, and it literally lit up the backyard. Okay, so that's one of it's sort of what I call indirect light trespass. There's a thing called light trespass. You shouldn't be lighting up your neighbor's yard. Lights from the roadway shouldn't be lighting up your yard. People, you know, talk about they have a right to the sun, to light in their house, but you also have a right to the dark, and you need the dark. We all need the dark. Every living organism needs a dark at night, bright in the daytime. Everybody needs to get outside and walk around and get in the sun for 20 minutes every morning. It sets your circadian rhythm.
Contrast.
Yeah, that's right.
And there has been a correlation between the invention of a light bulb, the loss of darkness, people working swing shift, the rise in cancers.
Okay.
It's all been linked.
Well, even your physical vision, I've read. If you place your hand over your eyes with space between your fingers, mm-hmm. It gets it simultaneously dark and light, and it actually relaxes your eye, your vision. Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
so it makes sense that if you've got a physical, fluorescent, crazy bright light, it's going to harm your vision.
Some of the issue. There's a number of issues associated with this. There's light at night and health, which we just kind of talked about. There's protecting the night sky in our national parks, for instance. We, in Sacramento area, we affect the night sky over Lassen National Monument. And we have displays 220 miles or thereabouts. The other thing is what we now call ecological light pollution. Changes in light, the light level that we have that spills from our city actually affects the animals, how they feed, their reproduction, their environment, many of them, in fact most of them, is the night. And we have created an environment that is no longer the night. And one of the things that I'm particularly concerned about recently is the light pollution in salmon. You know, we've got this big problem not only of drought, but we've been losing the salmon population, and only like 1% of the salmon return to the hatchery to their spawning area. And we're really concerned about the ones that naturally spawn. Those are the ones that are really important right now. And light on the river kills salmon. It causes them to stop their outmigration. And when I talk about salmon in that way, I'm talking about juvenile salmon, outmigrating small salmon that get eaten by predator fish or birds or whatever. And we've created, once again, an environment that's this, like the levels at dusk and dawn, the feeding times, So predation is extended because of the light that we waste out in our countryside. And in particular, when we look at the river, you know, people have talked in the Sacramento area about, well, we need to have the San Antonio River Walk. Well, the San Antonio River is not a river.
Man-made.
It's man-made lake is what it is. We have a natural, well, we have an unnatural path that salmon have to go down, that are endangered species that we are not protecting in this area. We're not protecting it by having light on the water. Because what happens when you have light on the water, the salmon begin their migration in the dark of the moon. They're naturally going to be migrating in the dark. And when they reach an area where it's lit, they have a tendency to drop out of the water column and go out to the edges. And you can imagine they think it's dawn and they need to go hide, right? Well, when they go hide, they go straight to the predators. All along the Sacramento River in around Sacramento is heavy amount of predator fish. So they hang out here because of the lighting. You might ask yourself, well, why do we have these sea lions down here? Well, there's a well-known case in the Northwest. In fact, when you talk about this subject, people up in the Northwest are much more in tune with it than many of us in the lower reaches of the salmon habitat. They had a heavy predation of salmon British Columbia and one of the heavy salmon runs, and what was part of the problem was the predation by the harbor seals. Well, one of the tools they were using is bridge lighting. Okay, they would use that as a tool. So they redid the bridge lighting, shielded much of it. And then there's another story in coming into Lake Washington where they put a pedestrian bridge and they put three lights on that bridge for safety. Just about destroyed a major salmon run up there. And what they did is they shielded the lights, got it off of the water, and it just basically the predation went to zero.
And it's still a safe place.
And it's still a safe place. And it's all about doing it right. It's not about taking all the lights away or whatever. It's about the right amount of light. We don't need a lot of light at night. Right? We were just recently up camping, and at 10 o'clock at night, no lights anywhere, you can just see fine. Eyes need to get used to the dark. That's what they're designed for. People have their houses all lit up, and they walk outside, and they think it's really dark out there because their eyes haven't adapted. Okay? And by the way, that's one of the issues with the salmon, too. They take a lot longer to adapt to the changes in light levels than we do. So when they get in one of these light areas, just like us, they're looking at a dark area beyond them. And they can't see. Before, when they started, they could see because they were dark adapted.
I have hiking friends that do not use flashlights at night.
No.
So there you go.
No, you don't need to do that.
Learn more at skykeepers.org. Tim Dunbar of the Mountain Lion Foundation advised that each year, 1,500 bobcats are killed in California for their fur. So there's a movement to ban the trapping of bobcats. If you would like to assist on this, contact mountainlion.org or Fish and Game. Let's not forget saving greenbacks. Mula money. The Community Skill Exchange is a way to exchange services on an equal time basis, as opposed to monetary bartering. Because it's based on time, not money, it's tax exempt. Any service you can think of. Legal, haircuts, music lessons, pet care, writing, errands, car repair, etc. See if one is in your area. And if not, start one yourself. More info at communityskillexchange.timebanks.org. Climate change. 350 is the safe upper limit for carbon dioxide in our atmosphere. That's parts per million. We are currently at about 390 and climbing. 350 Sacramento is a local grassroots climate change awareness organization, assisting in working toward climate change solutions by focusing regionally, such as climate-friendly events, actions, policies, and behaviors. May, for example, is Bike Month, to encourage people to ride their bicycles more than cars, such as group rides, to reduce carbon footprints, and halting the oil trains passing through the city. If you would like more information on how you can create a similar group in your area to assist in this global community crisis, visit 350sacramento.org or the national website at 350.org. The Wildlife Care Association helps rescued birds and animals, and there are a few important points that you should be aware of, such as not assuming that a young animal is abandoned just because it's alone. The parents may be waiting nearby. And did you know that using recorded or hand calls to attract wildlife can cause undue stress on some species? It can interrupt courtships, nesting, and feeding. If you have any questions specific to viewing or rescuing wildlife, contact wildlifecareassociation.net. Eco-housing, or co-housing, is growing in popularity for very good reasons.
The concept is you have a group of residences, homes, with a central common house where you can share meals. You don't have to do every meal, but take turns cooking. You don't have to cook every day or every day. You don't have to plan menus. You can find out what other people like to cook and eat. You get that variety. You don't get the care. You've got cooking facilities in your home, but you don't have to use them all the time. That's kind of like the co-housing. The eco aspect is that you try not to disrupt the earth too much. You know, the usual thing, like you try to use lumber from sustainable forests. You try to minimize any water runoff so it stays on your property and help recharge the groundwater when we ever get rain. Or you have really landscaping that doesn't require a lot of water, and at the same time you get the benefit of not a lot of maintenance. It's having housing where the residences are close enough, you don't have to get in your car and drive everywhere. If you run short of something, you can borrow from a neighbor for a while. You need a ride to the airport, you don't have to call the big blue van. See who's going that way. You got a leaky faucet. Well, you know, the common things. You know your neighbors. You know their names, your friends, you socialize with them. You're part of a community. Nowadays, the North Natomas area of Sacramento is just opening up to housing again. If you drive through there, you're going to see a lot of large houses on small lots, and maybe you know your neighbors. You look in the established neighborhoods of Sacramento, and sure, they've got that charm from the 1950s and so forth when they were built, and you knew your neighbors, but it's a fact of life. Nothing stays the same in these neighborhoods. Your friends get different jobs, they have to leave town, their marriages go to pieces, and the family splits, or your neighbor dies. Someone fresh comes in that you don't know from Adam. This tries to smooth out those ups and lows of community life by being in a more stable, friendly, knowledgeable community.
But someone may eventually move, so does the community decide who's allowed to move in the community?
There's a homeowners association, and they have you know, their normal restrictions like any condo. But I've never heard that asked before. Normally people that would be interested in the community would have similar goals in life and things they like and dislike.
But sometimes things happen, because that's life, and maybe you have a family issue and you have to relocate for personal reasons. Or as you say, somebody passes and they have to sell their home for taxes.
I think that there's provisions, or will be, that if someone comes into the community that is just not able to tolerate, the community would have to meet and decide whether or not to ask them to involuntarily leave. But, you know, that's a hard decision, because who are we to judge?
Well, that's what I'm saying. Initially, you're building a community of commonality.
Right.
And so, because I know that co-housing is popular in areas such as San Francisco, where rent is insanely high.
Right.
And so you have maybe 10 people sharing an apartment or a small home.
Yeah.
So you want to make sure you all have similar interests.
Correct.
So it's kind of a dicey razor's edge that you don't want to make a judgment that someone might turn around and sue you. But at the same time, you want to have like-minded
It's not so much like, look, there's nothing wrong with diversity and people having different thoughts. And not, you know, if we're all alike, we'd all be married to the same woman, period. So we all have different tastes, different outlooks on life, and that's kind of betrayal, because it makes life better. But I'm talking when you have someone who's a complete jackass.
I'm with you, believe me.
In that case, then...
I'm just thinking of the crazy Sue Happy world out there, and it's just gone insane. And I love the idea of building a community of people with shared interests. To me, it makes obvious sense. I'm a hiker, and you have your hiker buddies, and you go out, or your fishing buddies, because you like each other's company.
Correct.
You know, your companionship is similar. You get along. And so I think this is a lovely idea, and I like the idea that they're starting to really spring up more around the country. It's a great idea.
Good, thank you.
If you have more specific questions, visit fairoakshousing.org. I've saved the best for last. Grant High School students have created a business of delicious salsas made from natural ingredients.
So, what's your name?
My name is Kevin Tao.
And how old are you?
I'm 18 years old.
Is this a group project?
This is a student-run business from Grand Union High School. Our business is called Eat From the Garden Salsa, where we sell our salsa, which has two flavors, traditional and spicy peach. These recipes, students in the past came out with the recipes, and then now we're able to incorporate it into our business that we now do currently. Actually started from our school.
You have a garden?
We have a school garden. The academy actually arose from the salsa business. So we're able to establish an academy called the Grant Environmental Organization, which we now call GEO, which is on our salsa, which we can promote.
Our salsa is all organic. It's only $5 a jar. We're in Sacramento Co-ops, Davis Co-ops. We're in Taylor's Market. I thought we were in Trader Joe's.
No.
Trader Joe's yet, but we will be there.
That's right.
We'll be there. We are.
Are you online?
Yes, we're online at GHS Geo Academy. You can check out our salsa there, and you can actually order some, I believe.
Do you want to say that a little slower? You talk fast like I do.
www.
No, you don't need the W.
Just go to ghsgeoacademy.com, and you can find our salsa there.
Traditional or spicy peach. You know you want some. You can order them from Eat From The Garden. .org. So, did you receive enough information from the show? Do something different. Change the color of a room.